The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to Inside the Edition. Our guest is Greg Morris, a principal with GLM Engineering, and his experience includes hundreds of studies, including geologic and hydraulic analysis, water resources, and environmental studies. He is also the author of the story that appears on the Energy page in the September 2017 edition of Real Assets Advisor magazine. The headline of that article is Water Meets Turbines, and it is subtitled Hydropower Plants Offer an Alternative to More Popular Renewables. Obviously, those more popular renewables are solar and wind, which seems to be stealing all of the sunlight and wind these days, all of the attention these days. But water is in the mix and has been for a very long time, and it even spells opportunities for investors. Greg Morris joins us by phone from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Greg, welcome to the program.
How do you do, Mike? It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about hydropower now. The article references opportunities for investors, and we're not talking about the Hoover Dam here, a gigantic project like that. There are actually some smaller scale opportunities here that a high net worth or ultra high net worth individual could play in. Talk to us a little bit about the scale of the types of plants you're talking about and kind of the geography. Where do they exist in terms of geography, both nationally and maybe in terms of a geography within a nation?
Well, typically, we're looking generally at plants which in most countries classify as a renewable energy under renewable energy guidelines, typically less than 20 megawatts in different countries. Some countries will bring it up to 30 megawatts, but typically these are small plants. These are run-of-river plants. They do not use a large dam. They have a small dam, which may be only 5 or 10 feet tall, or maybe 20 or 30 feet tall, depending on the particular consideration of the local geography and topography. But they only use the water that flows in the river on a given day. And these are called run-of-river plants because they don't have storage. And these plants are located actually everywhere in the world where you have good topography, especially in mountainous areas where you have a lot of falling water. And the geographic location for new projects today tends to be the developing world. The U.S. generally, for the most part, built out most of its hydropower capacity in the early part of the 20th century, say up through 1950, 1960. But there are still sites that are being built and permitted in the U.S. at, for instance, existing dams where you have water that falls from one level to another to go, for instance, into an irrigation canal. These are prime sites where you can at times get permits to put a plant on. But for the most part, we're looking at the developing world and particularly areas such as in the Andean region, South America, Central America, in Asia, areas that have mountains around the Himalayan zone, which includes Nepal, India, Pakistan, that general area. There's a lot of activity also occurring in some of Southeast Asia, for instance, Vietnam. So it's anywhere you have water, anywhere you have water flowing downhill with a nice gradient, it's a potential opportunity for this type of plant. Of course, it will vary a lot depending on the country how interesting it might be from an investment standpoint, but geographically that's where it's located.
So fast-moving water, water moving at a pace that would spin a turbine. You mentioned 20 megawatts. When we talk about megawatts, are we talking about 20 megawatts? What is that, annually? Is it per month, per year? How do you actually measure that?
20 megawatts is your installed capacity, and what you're doing is you're actually not using the flowing water per se. What you would do is you use a dam and you build a tunnel or a pipeline to generate the pressure, and the pipeline would maybe go downstream 2, 3, 4 kilometers, it's about 2 miles, let's say, and then the pressure in the pipeline would run the turbines. And we're looking at typically plants that, for instance, you would spend maybe $1.5 million per megawatt, up to $2 million per megawatt. So we're looking at plants that would have a maximum construction cost in the realm of maybe $30 million. And these plants, of course, they can be done at all sizes. I mean, you can do less than a megawatt. But from what I have seen in a number of different countries, once you get through the permitting and everything else, it probably doesn't make much sense for an investor to look at a plant that's smaller than, let's say, 3 or 4 megawatts. Unless you have 2 or 3 plants that you can put together as a package.
Let's take that 20-megawatt plant. Give us a sense of the amount of energy that would generate. In other words, how many homes would it light or energize?
This is going to depend really on which country you're in. But let's say, and this is just a very, very round number, 20 megawatts is 20,000 kilowatts, and during a day, you would generate, if you're generating at full power 24 hours a day, you're doing 20 megawatts per hour. So you multiply that by 24, and you get 480 megawatt hours per day. And let's say that you are in a relatively energy efficient home, and let's say you're going to make a 10 kilowatts a day, it's enough for, say, you're in the range of 40 to 50,000 houses.
So
energy efficient, relatively energy efficient houses. So, it's quite a bit of power.
You know, you mentioned
but I would just like to say one more thing.
Sure.
And this is the really key point, is the issue of capacity factor or plant factor. You design, say, for 20 megawatts, but you're not going to operate at 20 megawatts 24/7 all year long, because the water flow is variable over the year. So your plant factor may be in the vicinity of 70%. So of your potential power, multiply that by 70%, let's say, and that's what you're actually going to get over the course of a year.
So are these plants usually supplemental power to a larger generating plant? Because, the thing is that I know that there's, more than 1 billion people around the world without energy, without power, or without consistent power. Are you talking in some cases that, this is going to produce good energy and keep things lit for part of the year, but there's going to be brownouts and whatnot? Or is this supplemental energy?
When you look at a large grid system, you have multiple energy sources. You have, for instance, Colombia. Colombia has a very high percentage of hydro, like almost 70%, but they also have gas plants and they have fossil fuel plants, so that when the dry season comes and your hydro is not producing as much as it does during the wet season, you have the fossil fuels that come in. Just like in the United States, you have a mix of hydro, you have nuclear, you have a variety of fossil fuels, you have solar, you have wind, and the solar and the wind are intermittent supplies because, you can't, they're going to vary between morning and evening, the time of the day. So, but hydro is has much less intermittency than these other renewable sources. Hydro, if it's in the dry season, your flow is going to be pretty steady, even though your plant is operating at, say, 30 or 40% of the capacity.
Well, now, you mentioned that, a 10-megawatt hydro plant can produce more energy than a 30-megawatt solar installation. Now, you're talking about capacity 3 times the size of the solar installation, but the hydro plant can produce more energy. Is this because of the lack of intermittency?
Yes, this is because of your plant factor. And that 30 to 1, you know, 10 to 30 ratio is considering that your panels are placed in a nice area like Arizona. If you're putting panels further north, the further north you go with solar panels, your capacity factor is going to go down, down, down. So, you know, the optimum you can get on solar is maybe 18% capacity factor, maybe max 20 in your ideal location. And hydro, we're looking at sites in Peru that I'm working in right now. We're looking at capacity factors close to 90% in some cases.
Wow.
It varies all over. The low end of that scale tends to be, for instance, in the Himalayan area, where you're looking at capacity factors closer to 50%, just because it's a monsoon climate. You have a lot of rain in the summer, and the winter is dry. So you have 4 months with a lot of water, and the rest of the year you've got not very much. In South America and Central America, you tend to have your rainfall is better spread out during the year. So because your water flow is more consistent, a run-of-river plant will typically give you on the order of 70%, or in some areas, even higher.
Now, you also mentioned in the article, and I think earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that hydroelectric or hydropower facilities, they're capital intensive, and investment is typically around $2 million per megawatt. But you mentioned that the annual operating costs only run about 2% to 3% of capital costs. So do the economics on that. This is where it could be interesting for an investor. I'm going to spend, you know, $30 million, let's say, on one of these plants, and what kind of returns are possible?
The plants that I've worked with, we're looking at returns to the investor on the order of an 18% internal rate of return. These are for small hydro, run-of-river, and if you have a really good site, you can get higher than that. But one of the problems with these hydro sites is, of course, that they're typically the new builds are outside the United States. So the investor will look for a higher return than, for instance, if the project was in the U.S. So 18% is around the type of number that people typically look at to get on these. And yes, you can do that at these sites. And the interesting thing about hydro is that not only it is capital intensive, but that capital lasts a long time. I worked in a plant in Peru a couple of years ago, and they're running 100 years on original equipment.
100 years on original equipment. So it's durable. It lasts, but is there anything? Yeah, I'm thinking in terms of better technology. Doesn't better technology come along and it's like, well, pull that stuff out and put this better, more efficient technology in there? Or is a turbine a turbine? You know, 50 years ago, it's really the same technology as we have today.
The technology has improved, but it's been an incremental improvement. So whereas a 50-year-old turbine, if it has not been abraded by sediment, if it's in original condition, you've just been running water through it, you could maybe be running at, let's say, 85 to 88% efficiency. And a brand new turbine would run at, say, 93% efficiency. But you know, this is not a huge number. It's not like a solar panel 50 years ago and a solar panel today. Remember, the electric power from water was the first way that electric power was generated. And you go to some place like Niagara Falls, and they've been generating power in Niagara Falls since, I believe, it's 1876.
Well, yeah, you say in the article that goes back, it predates solar and wind, and that it's been operating reliably for more than 100 years. So I interrupted you, though, Greg. Go ahead and finish that thought.
No, what I was going to say is that you do have to do up maintenance. For instance, in the one in Peru, they had replaced the original turbine runners after 50 years of operation, and they had also rewound the generators. But, you know, it's for the most part, these are just that type of maintenance things that you need to do. from time to time. But it's a very long-lived, it's a very robust, and it's a very solid and known technology. It's something that has been there for a long time, something you can really hang your hat on. And as an investor, you look at this as a cash cow that's just going to crank out energy forever. And the other interesting thing about the energy market, you know, everybody thinks about, you know, the oil market and how oil market has been so completely disrupted over the last 10 years by fracking. But the price of electricity has maintained itself pretty stable. And with the advent of electrification of the transportation system, automobiles, trucks, etc., we can look for continued growth in the electrical market, even in the United States. And if you look at developing countries, we're looking at annual growth in electrical power on the order typically of 6, 5, 6, 7, 8% annually, depending on which country you're in. So it's a huge, huge market internationally. And of course, electricity is the best form of energy because it is so useful for so many things.
So if I'm a wealth advisor and I've got a high net worth family and I'm looking to diversify their portfolio, I want them to be in energy, maybe I already have them in energy, but not in hydro, where does a wealth advisor look to find, are there funds that are currently available? Are there people out there raising hydro power funds, or how does somebody get involved?
I don't know of a hydropower fund per se. There are funds that have hydro as a component, including international hydro. I'm working with one such fund at the moment. We're trying to put together a couple projects, but you will have to shop around a little bit. And you would probably start by identifying the countries that you felt comfortable investing in. For instance, the World Bank and the IMF have country profiles that will rank different countries in terms of their suitability for investment. Stability, political stability, banking, their legal system, etc. So I would start identifying a target country first. You know, in South America, we're looking at places like Chile, Peru, Colombia. We're definitely not looking at places like Venezuela. Argentina is a question mark. Those are the types of things that you would look for. Some of the ones that actually come out a little bit surprising. We have done some initial inquiries in Nicaragua. And Nicaragua, although it's a leftist government, they have a very high demand for electricity. They want to electrify their country. And they have very interesting incentives. So it depends on where you're working. And it's, of course, very important, I should say it's essential, to have a good local partner. So it's not a type of market that you can enter into as easily as, for instance, you're not buying shares of GM or IBM or something like that. But if you can get into it, it's a very interesting market in terms of being able to generate a good return and being able to generate a return for a long time. It's a cash cow business.
This is obviously, I mean, based on what you wrote and what you're saying, this sounds like a really good opportunity for investors, but it's not in the conversation very much. Why has hydropower fallen out of the conversation? Why isn't it more a part of, I mean, it just doesn't come to mind when people talk about renewables. It tends to just be wind and solar that people think about. What gives here?
I think it's two issues here. First of all, when we talk about the quote-unquote Western world, developed countries, hydro has already been developed because it was the no-brainer energy source to develop right off the bat. So the opportunities that exist for new development are essentially wind and solar because hydro has already been developed to pretty much its full capacity given limitations that they've run out of sites, environmental limitations, regulatory restrictions, etc. But if you go to outside of the United States or outside the developed world where hydro is still, the sites are available, that is typically the area where you see the most activity. Solar and wind are developed secondary to hydro. So it depends basically on the setting that you are in. And then another problem that hydro has experienced is it has a bad name environmentally. And there are some really very high impact, environmental impact hydro projects that have been built and that are in construction and that are up to up for construction. What immediately comes to mind is the 135 or so hydro plants that are proposed in the Mekong Basin, potential for really huge adverse environmental impacts. And that's where hydro has gotten a lot of its bad name, bad press. But when you go to small hydro, you are high in the watershed. The higher you go in the watershed, the less species diversity you have. You get away from all these migrating species. You go high in the watershed. You get run of river, so you're not changing the hydro period downstream. In other words, the low flows and the high flows as they vary throughout the year, which is very important, especially on big rivers, Mekong, Amazon, because the floods flood the floodplains every year and support hundreds of species of fish, which are then used by local people for consumption. So the small hydro has gotten a little bit of a bad name because the big hydro has gotten a bad name. But it's like you need to separate the two in your thinking, and small hydro can be a very low-impact way of generating power, and it is the first thing you typically look at if you're in a developing area that has hydro potential. The one other thing that investors see as a potential problem in hydro, and it's a real problem, is the lead time for permitting and the potential for problems during construction, particularly if it involves tunneling, because tunneling is underground work, and you never know what you have until you actually get there with your tunneling crew. So those are the reasons why I see solar and wind as occupying, let's say, the high ground in terms of everyone's conversation, because once you get a solar site permitted, you can be producing power in a year. I mean, it's very simple. It's just you put the equipment out there and connect it to the grid. Hydro takes more time to develop. But like I said, you can get a much better return on hydro, and hydro is very, very long-lived.
Let's talk about these, as you call them, run-of-river hydro facilities. How many of them are there around the world? Do you have any kind of estimate on that? And how many are being built per year?
Wow, what a question. I have no answer. There are lots of these. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Depends on what size range you want to look at. Just to put this into perspective, there are worldwide about 80,000 large dams, and a large number of those, and these are dams that are more than 15 meters high, like 50 feet tall or higher. And small hydro uses small dams, and you know the number is for sure in the hundreds of thousands. There are a lot of these all over the world.
And lots more being built as now. They continue to build them at a brisk pace. This is something that... Go right ahead.
They're being built. Yeah, they are being built in most in developing countries. But, you know, it's really interesting because you go to a place like Germany, for instance, southern Germany in Bavaria, and you have these canals. And you walk through the town and you see these little tiny hydro plants operating on the canal. A canal has like a 5-foot drop, and someone has got a hydro plant sucking up that energy and putting it onto the grid. So like I said, there are lots of opportunities. Wherever you have falling water, you can do this. And these are, it's a technology which has been around for a long time. It's in a technology which is very widespread, and there are lots of opportunities. All I'm saying is that most of the opportunity lies in the developing world because it has already been developed pretty much to its close to its limit in most of the developed world, the Western industrialized countries.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So for those of you who are interested, there is more information in the article itself. It appears on page 21 of the September 2017 edition of Real Assets Advisor magazine. My guest has been Greg Morris. Again, he is a principal at GLM Engineering, and obviously well-schooled in water and power. And a very interesting conversation, Greg, and it sounds like a great opportunity for investors. I appreciate you taking the time.
It's been a pleasure to be able to talk to you and the listeners, and I hope that they find this interesting.